book of Judges tonight, and Judges chapter 3, and hopefully finish this chapter up and go into the next chapter. But chapter 3, again, we're going to begin to look at each and every one of these judges individually. And each one of these judges and their lives are preceded with this first verse here. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. And it says, so the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. And he gathered to himself the people of Ammon and Amalek, and went and defeated Israel, and took possession of the city of Palms. And so the children of Israel served Eglon, king of Moab, 18 years. That's a long time, you know. So we're going to talk about that. Diane, would you ask the blessing upon this word, please? Well, one of the things we know is that when God called men and women in this particular time especially to serve as judges, it seemed like they immediately obeyed. God had somebody that's prepared, ready to go. And they always did his work, sometimes begrudgingly or not willingly, but they knew that there was a call upon their life. You get people like Samson, you know, where, you know, it was a struggle to get him to do what was supposed to do, being a man who was under a Nazarite vow. And you know, he walked just like an unbeliever in a lot of ways, but nonetheless, he still had that call upon his life. I've always heard that when somebody has a call of God upon their life, and they can't fulfill that call, it's almost like something dies within you. There's just you just feel like you have to do it, you know. And I mean, if I were to ask you here tonight, how many of you feel like you have a call upon your life, a specific call to do something for the Lord? Again, you're never going to be satisfied until you do that thing. So they obeyed God, they did his work, and then they seem like they just passed from the scene. Each one of us are here for a specific reason, and that specific reason is to glorify God. However, he sees fit for us to glorify him. And so, again, we have to realize that things haven't changed a whole lot since the days of Judges. You know, God still uses men and women for specific things, specific purposes. I was listening to David Jeremiah, for example, this morning, and David Jeremiah was saying that he lived in Texas before they moved to Southern California. And he was afraid to move to California because of the earthquakes. And they had tornadoes there, but they were used to the tornadoes. And then one day he and his wife were in this room that he had built for a study above their garage, and something happened, and they thought the kids were playing and shaking the house and stuff, and they had an earthquake right there, you know. And so that's one of the things that prompted them to go ahead and move to California. The point he was trying to make, though, was that they had no intention of leaving there, that they wanted to live their life out there, and you know, but God had other plans for them. And thank God that he followed God's prompting and his call to go, because what a ministry he has now. It blesses so many people today. One would hope that these folks, they're godly influence, hopefully they would have a godly influence. Not all of them did, but they would make a difference in the spiritual life of the nation. But the truth is, if it did, it only lasted a short while. It's very sad. The nature of man, we're prone to do evil, you know. No sooner would a judge pass away that the people would just start worshiping the Baals and the Asherahs again and forsaking the Lord. You would think that the gratitude alone, the fact that, you know, that would have caused the people of Israel to obey the Lord and be faithful to his covenant, especially, you know, with the 18 years of painful servitude under that man, Rishuhathaim, and the king of Mesopotamia. But again, think about all that God did for them in the past, even, you know. That they would have been a forgotten nation, forgotten little nation, just a, you know, nobody would have even given them any thought if God had not loved them and chose them for himself and made them famous because of him. And I always am put in mind of Deuteronomy 7, verse 1 through 11, what God had said to them. And just in case you start thinking of yourself, I'm nobody. I'm really nobody special. Think about what he said to the nation of Israel here. When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you shall go to possess, and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites and the Gershonites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mighty than you, and when the Lord your God delivers you over to them, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them, and you shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor take their daughter for your son, for they will turn your son away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. But thus you shall deal with them. You shall destroy their altars and break down their sacred pillars and cut down their wooden images and burn their carved images with fire. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. Now I want you to think about this in the context of the fact that we are a special generation, holy generation, chosen priesthood for God, and we're supposed to be set apart as well. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples of the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love on you, nor choose you because you were more in number than any other people, for you were the least of all peoples. But because the Lord loves you, and because he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers, the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of bondage and from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Therefore, know that the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and mercy for a thousand generations with those who love him and keep his commandments. And he repays those who hate him to their face and destroys them. He will not be slack with them who hates him. He will repay him to his face. Therefore, you shall keep that commandment and the statutes and the judgments which I command you today to observe them. One of the things that I find interesting today is there is a lot of hatred towards the things of God, and particularly one political party even tried to put in their platform a few years ago. They wanted to take God out of their platform. A hatred toward God. The promise of God here, do you see what it says? For those who hate him, you know, he would repay them to their face. Yeah, to destroy them. And he will not be slack with him who hates him, but he will repay him to his face. That's certainly something to think about, and certainly something to warn people about. So again, they would have perished in Egypt, or they would have perished in the wilderness if God had not delivered them and cared for them. They would have died on the battlefields in Canaan if the Lord had not given them the victory over their enemies, because they certainly weren't powerful enough to do it. They also would have wallowed in moral sewage if the Lord had not given them his law, because that's what they were prone to, sin. And the fact that he gave them priests to teach it and to preach it. They had God's presence in the tabernacle. They had the promise of God in the covenant. So what more could they have wanted? Somewhere in the system, it broke down. It broke down. Most likely, it was the fact that the priests were not teaching. One of the sad things today, in a lot of the churches today, is they've gone from preaching the old-fashioned gospel to preaching what's called a social gospel. They're more concerned about social elements than they are getting people's souls saved. And I think that is kind of a picture, maybe perhaps, of what was going on here, you know. But I think it was most likely the priest. But I also believe it was partly because of the parents. The priests and the Levites were not only to officiate at the tabernacle, but they were supposed to teach the law to the people and continually encourage them to obey. But it was not only them, it was the parents that were supposed to teach this as well. In the law, Leviticus 10, verse 8 through 11, it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, do not drink wine or intoxicating drink, you nor your sons with you, when you go into the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die." Well, we know that Aaron had a couple of sons that did that very thing, and they died. "It will be a statute forever throughout your generations, that you may distinguish between holy and unholy, between unclean and clean, and that you may teach the children of Israel all the statutes which the Lord had spoken to them by the hand of Moses." Jewish parents were expected to teach the children the way of the Lord in what was called the Shema in the Jewish tradition. In Deuteronomy 6, verse 4 through 7, it says, "This is the Shema." It means hear. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength." Remember, this is the commandment the Lord said, the first commandment. "And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit down in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up." Now, we know that, but I was fascinated to find this is actually repeated again. And, you know, when usually when something's repeated, it's like God wants to put emphasis on something for us to understand and to grasp. In Deuteronomy 11, verse 18 through 25, it says, "Therefore you shall lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul, and you bind them as a sign in your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall teach them to your children, speaking to them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall write them on the doorposts of the house and on your gates, that your days and the days of your children may be multiplied in the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers to give them, like the days of the heavens above the earth. For if you carefully keep all these commandments which I command you to do, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and to hold fast to him, then the Lord will drive out all the nations from before you, and you will dispossess greater and mightier nations than yourself. And every place on which the sole of your foot treads shall be yours, from the wilderness and Lebanon, from the river Euphrates, even to the western sea, shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand against you. The Lord your God will put the dread of you and the fear of you upon the land, all the land where you tread, just as he has said to you." I find this is interesting, isn't it? You know? That the Lord was going to do this work for them if they only taught their children and they themselves kept this. The Lord would have gone before them and fought all their enemies and given them the land. So you see where the fault lies. The fault lies with the fact they weren't being taught by the priests and the fact they weren't being taught by the parents. I just posted on Facebook that if church is an option to you, then it will become an option to your children. And that's true. And again, during this period of Judges, it's apparent that the older generation is the one who dropped the ball. They neglected the important ministry of instructing the new generation about the fear of the Lord. And one of my favorite verses in Psalms that tells us clearly what the fear of the Lord is, it's in Psalms 34. And I'm just going to read a couple of verses of it, but it's verse 11 through 14. "Come, you children, listen to me, and I will teach you the fear of the Lord. And if you don't come away from here tonight with remembering anything else, please remember these verses here, because they're very important for all of us as believers. Who is the man who desires life and loves many days, that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil and do good, and seek peace and pursue it. Problem is, we have a heart that is desperately wicked and is prone to sin. And it does take strength of character and integrity to be able to stand and to walk in God's word. That's why we must come daily and wash in the water, the cleaning of the water of the word, so that we can wash away that old filthiness. Because if we don't, it's going to get stuck there, man, and it's going to be hard to clean, you know. But God's word, it cleanses us from all unrighteousness. The armies of Mesopotamia came a pretty long ways to invade Israel. But the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Amalekites were just, they're just right next door. They were neighbors. They were also relatives of Israel. Lot, Abraham's nephew, was the ancestor of Moab and of Ammon. Also, Esau was the brother of Jacob, who was an ancestor of Amalek. Now, Eglon, when I heard that name, I first heard it, I thought, man, that's a funny name, Eglon. And I picture this guy shaped like an egg, you know. And he's the king of Moab. Anyway, he organized this confederacy, and he set up his headquarters in Jericho. He took that city, Jericho. That's the city of palm trees. And Eglon made life miserable for the Israelites. And so the people, they cried out to the Lord. And I think that's really what it has to come to. When we get sick and tired of being sick and tired because of sin, people finally cry out to God. I know that, you know, a lot of the problems that we end up being, they had these armies that were encompassing them causing them problems. But, you know, I think they're typing a shadow, a picture of the sins that does so easily beset us and come against us. And people get into bondage to these sins as well. People get into bondage to pornography, get into bondage to gambling, get into bondage to drinking, get into bondage to, well, you know, they become workaholics, and that can be a bondage as well. You know, and they neglect their families. You know, there's so many things that you can get under bondage to, but only God can break that bondage. And sometimes, you know, it takes us getting to that place where God will send the deliverer, Jesus Christ. He's the only one who can set us free. All of these judges are a type and a shadow of Christ who sets the people of God free. In verse 15 through 19, it says, "But when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. By him, the children of Israel sent tribute to Eglon, king of Moab." Now, Ehud made himself a dagger. It was double-edged and a cubit in length. It's probably about 18 inches. He fastened it under his clothes and on his right thigh. And so he brought the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. And when he had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who had carried the tribute, but he himself turned back from the stone images that were at Gilgal and said, "I have a secret message for you, O king." So the king said, "Keep silence." And all who attended went out from him. So here we have Ehud from the tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin means the son of my right hand, but God's going to use his left hand. I find that ironic, to do this work. So what was the significance of him being left-handed? Well, I think the truth is the text of 3:15 can be translated the fact that the man was handicapped in his right hand. That's why he was left-handed. And again, if you read it, it says, "But the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, and the Lord raised up and delivered to them Ehud, the son of Gera, Benjamite, a left-handed man. By him, the children of Israel sent tribute to King Eglon, king of Moab." So again, the text can be translated the way it's written, that he was actually handicapped. And again, this suggests that he was not ambidextrous, even though the tribe of Benjamin were known to be so. They were known to be ambidextrous. And in 1 Chronicles 12, verse 1 through 2, I thought this was fascinating. It says, Now these were the men who came to David at Ziklag while he was still a fugitive from Saul, the son of Kish. And they were among the mighty men, helpers in the war, armed with bow, using both right hand and left hand in hurling stones and shooting arrows with the bow. They were of Benjamin, Saul's brethren. I thought that was kind of interesting. You know, they were known for that. But this is, to me, you know, interesting. But it's also very interesting to me that, again, God uses somebody whom the world would seem foolish to use. He uses a handicapped man to take down Israel's greatest enemy. You know, it should be of real encouragement to people who have physical disabilities who think, well, God can't use me. I'm left out of the service of God because I have a disability. He used this man. He just needs somebody who's got a willing heart, and he'll do the work. And I think that's where this verse of scripture in 1 Corinthians 1:27 through 29, it says, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty, the base things of the world and the things which are despised. God has chosen, and the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. And again, we see Ehud here. He's got several problems that he's got to solve if he's going to do this. Yeah, I'm sure he has this call on his life to do something special. But at the top of the list, he's got to gain access to Eglon without making anybody suspicious. Now, he accomplishes this by making himself a leader of the commission that brought to the king this annual tribute. And no doubt he may have had conversation to put the king's mind at ease and what have you. The paying of the tribute, it was actually something that acknowledged the king's authority over Israel. But if Eglon knew that Ehud was God's appointed leader and a deliverer of Israel, he probably would have had him killed right on the spot. The second problem they had to overcome was, again, securing a private audience with the king without exciting the distrust of the attendants and the guards. Ehud did this first by leaving the king's presence, and again, together with his men, on their way out, and after they paid homage to Eglon, and everything, they started on their way out, and before he gets all the way out of the room, he turns and he says, "Oh, king, I've got another, that reminds me, you know, kind of like, that reminds me, I've got a message for you, a secret message." And the king says, "Be silent." And the reason why he said that is because there was a lot of ears there, you know, and I'm sure that he thought, well, this can't trust everybody, even, somebody in his own court, those that he would consider close to him could use it against him. And so he orders all of his attendants out. And, of course, they took a look at Ehud and they saw that he was a crippled man, no doubt feel like he's no threat because he's just one man who's handicapped. And since the king was okay with it, and I'm sure they thought, okay, well, that's okay. I think it'll be all right. Now, since Ehud had to kill King Eglon in a way that was quick and quiet, that would catch the king by surprise, but it would totally keep those who attended him in the dark. And because he had to do that, he made use of this disability that God had gave him. He made a very sharp dagger, and he hid it under his clothing on his right side. And even if the guards did frisk him, they might, examine the left side of his body, where most men carried their weapons. But seeing that he was, a handicapped man, again, they probably didn't even examine him at all. I would think that would be the case, wouldn't you? You know, And so verse 20 through 22, it says, and so Ehud came to him. Now he was sitting upstairs in his cool private chamber. And Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And so he arose from his seat. He's standing up now. He's standing up. Then Ehud reached with his left hand, took the dagger from his thigh, and thrust it into his belly. Even the hilt went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the dagger out of the belly, and his entrails came out. Kind of gross, huh? So, again, when the king stood like this to receive this message from God, Eglon probably got really close to him, maybe tried to, like he's going to whisper in his ear. But anyway, did something, maybe gestured with a hand or something to, you know, distract him. And he pulled this dagger out and he plunged it into his fat belly, literally even sticking a hand into that belly, you know, where it covered over the hilt of the blade. But it came back out on the other side, and as a result, his entrails from the backside came out. But from the front, didn't look like anything was wrong with him. So it obviously hit vital organs because the king was dead instantly. In verse 23 through 25, it says, then Ehud went out through the porch and shut the doors of the upper room behind him and locked them. And when he had gone out, Eglon's servants came to look, and to their surprise, the doors of the upper room were locked. And so they said, he's probably attending to his needs in the cool chamber. He's probably in the bathroom. That you know. And so they waited till they were embarrassed. And still he had not opened the door of the upper room. Therefore he took the key and opened them. And there was the master fallen dead on the floor. So again, we see the next problem was how to escape the palace without getting caught. And again, he accomplished this by locking the door of the private chamber that delayed the discovery of the king's corpse. The attendants assumed that the meeting that they were having was over, and that Eglon must have been in the, like I said, been in the bathroom. But the fact that they waited so long, to go in and check him and what have you, that gave Ehud and his men time to escape. I honestly believe that if God guides, he provides. And even what Ehud would probably think that, well, I want to do this and that and the other, I believe perhaps God put it in his heart to do those things and that God was orchestrating this whole thing. This was a message from God, that Ehud gave. In verse 27 through 30, it says, but Ehud had escaped while they delayed and passed beyond the stone images and escaped to Syria. Not the same Syria that we know today, but it's a place called Seirah. And it happened when he arrived that he blew the trumpet in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel went down with him from the mountains, and he led them, and he said to them, follow me, and the Lord has delivered our enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. And so they went down after him and seized the fords of the Jordan leading to Moab and did not allow anyone to cross over. And at that time they killed about 10,000 men of Moab. That's a heap of men, you know. All stout men of valor, not a man escaped. And so Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. Like I said, his final problem was really probably to rally the troops and attack the enemy. That trumpet signal called these men out, and he led them to these fords of Jordan. Now, this was a place where the water was shallow enough for people to wade across. And he assured the men that the Lord had given Moab into their hands and that Eglon was dead. One of the reasons why they always try to take out the general, the chief, and things like that is because, you know, if you take them out, the followers scatter, you know, and don't have as much strength. And so the victory would come by trusting the Lord, though, and not by depending upon their own strength. Because notice what it said here. It said the men were men, stout men of valor. But by guarding the fords, the Israelites prevented the Moabites from escaping from, the place, and also from going and getting fresh troops. 10,000 soldiers of the best Moabite soldiers. That's, like I said, that's a lot of men. Not only was Moab defeated, but the tables were turned on the Moabites, and they became subject to Israel. Do you remember when the Lord took the people of Israel out of Egypt before they left? Do you remember what the Egyptians did? They gave them gold. They gave them all manner of valuable things like that. God can turn the tables on this world. Whenever the enemy comes in like a flood, God can lift that standard against them. And if the Jews had been asked to vote on a leader, most likely Ehud probably would not have even been considered. God chooses the foolish things to confound the wise. Brother Horton used to say, I was asked to pastor the church, and I'm waiting for the pastor to come. I was asked to take over until the pastor come. I'm still waiting for the pastor to come. It was like 34 years later, you know. And so here I am, you know, I'm pastor of this church, and I wonder, Lord, why is it you're using me here? I think it's obvious, you know, because he uses things that are base, things that are people wouldn't consider to be what God would use, and he gets the glory for it. Ehud was God's choice, and God used him to set the nation free. Moses was slow of speech. Paul, he was not an imposing figure in his appearance. Remember what they said about him? His speech is contemptible, and his bodily presence, you know, it's not much. But Moses and Paul and Ehud, again, were all men of faith who trusted the Lord. Ehud turned disability into possibility, because he depended upon the Lord. And we can do the same thing. Don't ever think that God can't use you because of a disability that you have. And I think that's what Ehud serves as an example for us as, you know, and we should always remember that.
Is there a place where it says he is handicapped?
In the original language, if you read how it's written, you know, it kind of infers the fact that he's handicapped, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember reading the story. Yeah.
Yeah.
That
yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to read some more commentary on it, but most people, I believe that he was, you know, handicapped in some way.
Yeah. Well,
because he was a left-handed man, you know. And
because he's left-handed?
Yeah, he used his left hand. And, you know, that he must not have been a very imposing figure. And there must have been something there that the king would literally trust himself to be alone with him, you know. So something to think about.
Yeah.
Yes.
I had a withered arm.
A withered arm. Yeah. Yeah.
Like
yep. Yeah. No threat. Yeah.